Money and markets. So that's the theme. The empire draws capital home, and this is a very big deal, and this is a big change. Think of it as the financial coup d'etat is over. Bernanke has the big banks back on their feet. Not to say that we're not going to see some real squeezing and reconfiguring in the financial sector in the developed worlds. We are. We're going to talk a little bit about that later. But now we're ready to proceed to the next phase. I think Mr. Global has in mind that it's going to be a bull phase for the United States. So let's see what happens. So with that, let's turn to money and markets. And I want to start with housing because our interview this week, which we posted this afternoon, was with a wonderful young scholar, Dr. Zinnia Mukherjee from the American Institute of Economic Research. I wanted to have a back-to-basics conversation about housing because the housing market is up. We're getting a lot of questions about, should I refinance my home? Should I buy a home? Particularly in the face of announcements that in April the prices were up in 20 big urban markets, up about 12% from on a year-to-year basis now. Let me just unpack those numbers a little. Those numbers include a very significant amount of institutional buyers. We've seen institutional buyers jumping in and buying up single-family homes for rental and doing the equivalent of what I call roll-ups. In fact, as interest rates have been rising as a result of what Ben has been doing, a series of major IPOs for some of those roll-ups have been shelved and raised the cost of capital for the for some of those aggregators, and that's going to have a shift in the market. So expect to see the institutional investors slow down a bit. And as that happens, even though I think individual investors are going to be more interested, interest rates are going to cool it off. And we are, of course, coming into summer. So don't be surprised if the May, June, and July numbers are maybe a little less exciting in the housing market. One of the reasons I wanted to do this interview is if you look at the culture in America, it's sort of the lore of the American culture that home ownership is a good thing to do. It's a good financial deal. People are encouraged to do it. Now, if you go back and you look at the price of a home in the United States, a lot of the increase in valuations have been driven by several things. One is the mortgage interest deduction. So we've had very generous deductions for mortgage interest on federal and state taxes. Then you have just a pouring of federal credit into the mortgage market. So we have FDIC credit, we have FHA, we have VA, we have Fannie, Freddie. And all of these things have fueled an enormous amount of low-cost capital and relatively easy terms. Then, of course, we've had currency debasement and inflation and a rise in the value of the homes, really coming from a fall in the value of the currency. And finally, we've seen a significant growth in the size of homes around the country. And when you go back and you look at the historical rise of prices in homes and you unpack and sort of delete all those factors, what you realize is, you know, a home purchase can be as much consumption, if not more consumption, than it is inflation. I always marvel when I'm in Switzerland because so many of the Swiss see the purchase of a home as consumption and not investment. Why would you ever waste your good investment capital on buying a big home? The Swiss are much more reluctant to do that. Anyway, so you've had all these factors that put the wind at your back, you know, or the wind in your sails when it comes to home ownership. And I think there's a significant question as to whether those benefits will be there to support the market and what could happen if there's withdrawn. We've seen different policy discussions in Washington about removing support for Fannie and Freddie, privatizing Fannie and Freddie, trouble financially at FHA. All of that is simply the fact that if you look at what it takes to balance the budget, withdrawing investment capital from the mortgage markets and shifting it into the corporate or business or equity markets is very attractive for a whole variety of sort of overall policy basis. And that puts, you know, whether it's the federal credit or it's the mortgage interest deduction, that sort of puts, you know, these benefits at play. And if they get withdrawn from the market, it can make a significant difference into how house prices will grow. The second thing is we've seen tremendous divergence in the economy. So there are some parts of the country that are doing very, very well, others that are doing terribly. We tend to be people who move around. When you have that kind of divergence and you get caught in the wrong place, things can be very painful. Finally, there is deterioration in the integrity of a home. I put up a wonderful quote from Confucius about the integrity of a nation comes from the integrity of a home. The integrity of a home is really under attack. So property rights are very much under attack in America, whether it's, you know, the NSA invading our homes through our cell phones to listen into conversations, or smart meters, which can access all sorts of information about what's going on in the house through the Wi-Fi systems. Agenda 21, which really, you know, sort of starts to negate our water and mineral rights. There's all sorts of other risks. If you get a mortgage, we see more and more servicing and mortgage fraud. I just put up a story about Bank of America by one of my favorite financial journalists, Jonathan Weil, over at Bloomberg, on the servicing really criminal fraud at Bank of America. It's an enormous, just a hideous story. But there's also corruption in the general population when it comes to buying a house and making sure you know what's really going on, what the problems are, quality of appraisal, inspection, all these other things. And then, of course, you have property taxes and the fact that once you own a home, you're sort of on the list to dig the municipality out of problems if they should have it. So what we have is a situation, and the other thing I should mention is if you look at any estimate by various researchers and experts on how much time it takes you to care for and manage a home, and of course it's much more time the bigger the home is, what you start to realize with all these things, whether it's integrity, whether it's financial, whether it's risk issues, is that buying a home is a major commitment. It can involve you with all sorts of characters that you don't necessarily won't enjoy being connected to. It's a complex decision. It's essentially a riskier decision, and it's one that takes a greater investment of upfront time and thought than it certainly did when I started out and bought my first home. So this is something you should approach with care, and you should really research and know what you're doing, because it's the kind of investment where there are 1,000 variables and one of them are enough to kill you. And so it requires a thoroughness and a complexity, that's very sobering. And so it was one of the reasons I wanted to just revisit housing. Do I want to own a home? What are the considerations? One of the best things about the interview is Dr. Mukherjee basically said, look, you have to decide both resources and time, so your money or your time, how much do you want to spend on a house, and what are the other things you can do with that resources and time? And I think that's a very important and very good question to ask, particularly as the signs of strength in the housing market make it all the more enticing for us to jump in. Okay, one of the things that could soften real estate a little bit is we've seen with Ben's announcement, interest rates had been sneaking up. And of course, as you know, we've been talking on the Saleri report about the fact that it's hard to imagine that interest rates could continue to come down anymore. But interest rates started to sneak up. And of course, after Ben's announcements, they really jumped. We saw REITs get hammered about 5 to 10%, bond funds trade off about, depending on the bond fund, 5 to 12%, record outflows from bond funds. And I asked our producer, Justin, to put up one of the charts of the U.S. bond aggregate. And you can see the prices of bonds have been falling. I think it's an overreaction. If you look at the sort of interest rates and the way they've been trading in a channel, we're well within the channel, and it wouldn't surprise me to see things turn as they have in the last 1 to 2 days. So to me, it looks like we're in a channel. And I think sort of the Bill Gross's announcement that the long-term bull in the bond market is over is a little bit premature. I would note a very important development that we've been waiting for. Gary Gensler, chairman of the CFTC, continues to insist that he's coming out with a new swap regulations in the clearance system that was required by Dodd-Frank. given that those swaps, the single biggest volume in swaps is interest rate derivatives, and interest rate derivatives have made a mighty contribution to keeping interest rates down. Not to mention swaps have been very important to sort of manipulating the price of precious metals. So what those new clearance systems will be and what effect they would have on the swap market could be significant. Gensler insists the banks are ready to implement them, but it will be very interesting to see what happens. That comes in July. It's one of those trim tabs that, I always watch out for, because if it hiccups anything, we could get some pretty wild results, or we could just sail through. But it's, kudos to Gensler for hanging tough. It's something we need. Precious metals, we've seen the continued divergence between the U.S. equities and the commodities markets. Just when you think it can't keep going or diverge anymore, it does. We've seen precious metals price continue to move downwards. I asked Justin to post up a chart of the miners, the miner ETF against the triple bear. And you can see anybody who bet big against gold and the miners did well. The price of gold just closing, holding above 1,200 today. That's put prices at this point below the marginal cost of production, and we're starting to see the mining companies throw in the towel. Canadian mining giant Barrick announced they were laying off 30% of the office staff. That's a pretty big deal. Numerous small companies have started announcing that they're shutting down or they're shutting down operations. I expect to see a whole bunch of mergers, and I think you've got 500 to 1,000 companies on the Canadian exchanges or in the U.S. exchanges that just are not going to make it. We continue to see the regulatory apparatus used to terrorize gold and silver investors, both in the United States and Europe. I just keep lists every day of the things reported into me. One of the stories I tell, and this happened to me personally, one well-known broker demanded several weeks ago that anyone with 20% more of their account in precious metals was asked to leave and told to leave and leave quickly. FINRA, the financial regulator, was coming in, and more than 20% was a violation of the suitability rule in Dodd-Frank. Meantime, the head of the firm kept sending everybody emails saying, don't sell your precious metals. It was one of those whoa giddy-ups. But the fear in their voice was noticeable, and so you have the regulators basically making it impossible for brokerage firms to basically satisfy clients who want to own precious metals. The biggest one, of course, was another margin rise on the COMEX. All you have to do is bring the margin price up, and you'll squeeze out the speculators and scare everyone. But the squeeze on China and India could easily be as big a part of the story, because the emerging markets are the biggest retail markets for precious metals, and they're getting clobbered. And slower growth rates in China and India are certainly going to contribute to lower demand and lower prices in precious metals, although we certainly get reports as the price come down of major buying by retail there. It's not just precious metals that's getting the hits. The empire doesn't want leakages. Precious metals is a leakage, just like Syria is a leakage and what Putin is up to is a leakage. There's another leakage we've talked about, and that's Bitcoin. More pressure from state and federal regulators. One of the things you're seeing on Bitcoin, just like you see on gun control or many of these other issues, when a big federal push can't get the work done, you see them pull back, and then about 2 or 3 months later, it starts to pop out at the state level. Bill Moyers had a wonderful interview on some of the mechanisms they use to then get together with all the states and start to put this stuff out on the states. It was up a couple months ago. It's somewhere on the blog. But we talked on the Salieri Report at that time about Hot Coffee, which is a great documentary that we did in Let's Go to the Movies on tort reform. And it's an example of sort of how you go state by state. And when you can't get something with a big bang in Washington, you go play trench warfare to get it. But we're going to start to see the state guys go after Bitcoin. And again, that's shutting off the leakage. After the insiders are repositioned with precious metals, I think the shutdown of the miners that's happening right now will make their positions all the more valuable. But it could take a while, and don't be surprised if prices can go lower. Franklin has always said that we could see 1,100 and still be in the primary trend. Others say lower, but it wouldn't surprise me to see us go down to 1,100. July 11th, we're going to be joined by James Turk and Franklin Sanders for the Precious Metals Market Report and we're going to have a very interesting conversation. James, of course, watching the international markets, Franklin watching the U.S. markets, and operating, you know, with coins at the retail level. We'll start to talk about what's the divergence of the paper markets and the physical markets and what's happening and what they see. I think the one thing to remember is I've been so surprised this week how few people understand what the bail-ins are and what's coming. If you remember what happened on Cyprus, we had resolutions of banks without bailouts, but in fact bail-ins. A bail-in is where the resolution is funded by writing down some or all of the uninsured depositors and writing down some or all of the creditors. So they can get 100% write-up or a partial write-off. In Cyprus, a little more scary, we saw even insured deposits frozen for some period of time. And so you literally, unless you had gold, you couldn't buy feed to feed your livestock. And of course, that's one of the reasons they want to shut off leakage like that. But leakage is a good thing to have. So when you think about your precious metals, I really encourage you to think, divide precious metals up between sort of two pots. One is, how much do you need per person in the worst case, you know, if you're in a Cyprus kind of situation, and then your investment portfolio, and you need to approach them very, very differently. The core position is about being free. It's not just about making money. One of the things I want to talk with James and Franklin about is, you know, for many years I've been the proponent of slow burn, and I think the system has far more power to engineer prices with a managed process. And so this will give us an opportunity to revisit that, because we are certainly watching the exercise of those powers with extraordinary, extraordinary global reach, not just in the United States and England, but throughout the continent, and then G7 acting with power around the world. A couple other stories I want to mention tonight. The president's new proposal on climate change very much is a targeting of coal. There's an important subtext you need to understand. Solar and renewables are in the process of taking coal out because of the fundamental economics. It's just the way it is. A lot of it is attributable to the Chinese that have run the cost of solar panels way down in a way that's very putting a lot of, you know, Western solar companies under tremendous financial pressure or out of business. But whether good or bad for us, the Chinese have really pushed the cost of solar panels down, and we're now seeing solar panels reaching the point where solar can, in fact, compete with coal. Now, that's a, you know, that's not a practical application. That's going to take another 1 to 3 years. But we're headed into a world where a wide selection and variety of renewables is going to get much more competitive, as we're seeing development of the battery technology. That's even going to, you know, turbocharge it. The big issue with solar, wind, some of the renewable energies is that they're not a consistent, sort of faithful, steady supply, and that's where you need the batteries. You get the battery technology economic and reliable, and then suddenly renewables get powerful in a way that they haven't been. And I think renewables are only going to grow over the, you know, from here on out. It's and this is fundamental economics, but the president seems to be taking advantage of it for political purposes. Of course, one pressure on him is to keep doing all of the things we're doing to improve domestic supply in oil and gas, including improving the Keystone pipeline to bring oil down from the tar sands. In the new proposal, he's saying he will only approve it if it's net indifferent in terms of the carbon and climate, and it's kind of a neat little trick, since various experts have already said it is only because the Canadians will be harvesting that oil, whether we pipe it in or not. Go take a look at the stock charts of the coal companies. It's, you know, you can always say one of the good things in your life is that you're not running a coal company right now, because that is a very ugly situation for them. And very ugly charts. Big story about the Supreme Court basically taking a punt on gay rights, moving it back to the lower court jurisdiction, which as a result is a practical matter, then holds in favor of gay marriage. Significant financial reverberations. Most people are just celebrating or bemoaning the case depending on their point of view, but I don't think anybody started to realize what the financial implications are going to be to a wide variety of pension funds and Social Security. So, you know, don't be surprised if if there is, you know, sort of the tectonic plates are shifting financially as a result of that. Under, oh, by the way, but please, 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 please listen to this. It's very important. There was a report, and it's up on the blog last week, that Facebook had offered an organ donor registration and had gotten an unbelievably positive response. Please, whatever you do, do not register your organs on Facebook or any place else. Do not give Mr. Global a list of, you know, what parts of your body are available and might be attractive. Because if you think that it won't be, you know, that you won't be the subject of dirty tricks or you don't live in that kind of environment, I just don't think that's fair to say. Let's say the chance is only 1%. Why should you take that risk? Please, please do not give anybody the particulars of your organs and why they're attractive for somebody else. We've posted several announcements on the blog. We do have 3D printers making organs for human transplant. That technology has quite a ways to go before it's ubiquitous, but I hope it does faster than Mr. Global starting to look at all of the healthcare databases for available organs.